This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In the wake of President Obama's 2012 re-election, Donald Trump sent out a tweet calling the Electoral College a disaster for democracy. Not quite sure why President Obama won both the popular and the electoral vote, but if Trump didn't quite get how the system works, he wasn't alone. Folks have been questioning the how and why of the Electoral College for generations. Joining me now is Bill Marshall. He's the Keenan Professor of Law at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He was also Deputy White House Counsel and Deputy Assistant to the President during the Clinton administration. Bill Marshall, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be on.
Good to have you. Now, listen, this is the second time in 16 years that the candidate who got the most votes didn't get the job, and that's because of the Electoral College. So explain to us, please, how this thing works.
Well, the way it works is that we technically actually don't vote for the president. We vote for electors in each state, and the electors then cast their votes for a president that they are pledged to. The Congress counts them up, and the presidency is awarded on the basis of who gets the most electoral votes and not who gets the most popular votes.
Okay, so how many electoral votes are there, and how are they apportioned?
They're apportioned on the basis of population. They roughly coincide. Each state gets two automatically, which actually coincides with how many senators they have, and then gets an electoral vote for each congressional district they have beyond that, which is an allocation on the basis of population.
All right, so there you go. Now, interestingly enough, the Electoral College is set up at the federal level, and in other words, structurally, that's where we get the rule that provides for an Electoral College, but it's up to the states to write the rules about how it's actually designed on a state-by-state level, right?
That's correct.
Tell us how it works. Let's start with the state of North Carolina, for instance. How does it work in North Carolina?
Well, in North Carolina, the electors pledge to a particular candidate, and there is a provision in North Carolina law that if the elector decides not to vote for the candidate to which he or she is pledged, then their vote doesn't count, and it's considered resignation, and then they move on to an alternative. There is some question with respect to that of whether how much authority the states have to actually interfere with that, but that's pretty much how it's designed at the state level.
But that's here in North Carolina. In other words, in other states, you might not be pledged, right?
Correct.
And is that true in any state?
Yeah. Usually you're pledged in all states. In terms of enforcement of it, I think it's about 29 that enforce the pledge and 21 do not have any particular enforcement of the pledge.
So who are these electors? How are they chosen? Are there pools pledged to each candidate waiting to be called depending on the results? Or who are these people?
Well, usually the parties are involved in picking the electors, and those are party loyalists, usually aligned with a particular candidate with whom they're supported. So it's not random. I mean, the people are picked on the basis of their involvement with the party and their involvement with a particular candidate.
All right. So, but in a case where perhaps the party machinery or the mainstream party doesn't particularly like the candidate who won the primary, for instance, how would that sort itself out in the election?
Well, there is a possibility of the so-called faithless elector. That is an elector who votes against the way the state actually went. And there have been a few times in American history where there have been faithless electors. For example, a West Virginia elector didn't like Michael Dukakis very much and voted instead for his vice presidential candidate, Lloyd Benson. If we go back to 1968 in North Carolina, an elector did not vote for Richard Nixon but instead voted for George Wallace. But the instances of the faithless elector have been very few and far between. I understand in this cycle there is an elector from the state of Washington who has indicated that he is more likely to vote for Bernie Sanders than he is for Secretary Clinton. But for the most part, the electors have taken their job seriously. They've understood what they are doing, and they will vote for the person who has received the largest popular vote in their state.
And I'm guessing that there's never been a case where faithless electors have actually changed the outcome, so it's never really been challenged, right?
That's correct. It's never changed the outcome.
So what about the system? I mean, we think we have a democracy here. First of all, let's go back. I said twice in 16 years. Of course, it happened in 2000 where Al Gore got about 500,000 more votes than George W. Bush, didn't win the election. Here we've got a 200,000 vote differential in favor of Hillary Clinton, not going to get the job. Twice in 16 years. Before then, when did it happen?
I think the last time it happened before then was in the 19th century. It was the last time that happened. But it does happen from time to time. And I think when the Electoral College was set up, people understood that it might happen that way. And part of that was because they wanted to give and make sure that smaller states got the requisite attention that they didn't think would happen if you just counted the entire vote.
And, of course, that was a time, particularly when the country was being put together, we were writing the Constitution, states were far more differentiated than they are today, and the power that resided within those states kind of made a difference, and there's a great worry. You can see it reflected in the entire Constitutional Convention about the balance of power between these states in this new federation, right?
That's right. And, yes, we were much more concerned, I think, at that time. Than we are now. The states were greater differentiated in terms of culture, in terms of political history than they are now. I think that's exactly right.
These days, are there any real advantages to having a system in place that can deliver results as it has twice in 16 years where people aren't getting who they want?
Well, I mean, there's one thing to think back about that is that although in this particular case, Secretary Clinton won the popular vote, that might not have happened if what people were campaigning for was the most popular vote instead of winning the Electoral College. The way the campaigns design their campaign is to win the Electoral College. If you were trying to get the greatest popular vote, you would do a different tactics. Like Secretary Clinton undoubtedly would have spent more time in California to mine a very pro-Clinton state of a lot of votes. I'm sure Donald Trump would have spent time in Texas and other very red states to get a greater amount of voters out. So what the particular popular vote reflects in this instance is the tactics of the campaigns. It might very well be that Secretary Clinton would have won a majority of the popular vote had the candidates campaigned to get the popular vote, but that's not what their particular strategies were in this instance.
But are there any advantages to, I mean, again, structurally you're set up to have this kind of result. Is there any advantage to this and not just doing what you said, to changing your tactics, changing your strategy, and trying to get more people to vote for you than the other candidate?
Well, I think there are two major disadvantages of the Electoral College. One you referred to, even the optics of the fact that somebody doesn't win the popular vote not winning the presidency seem awkward in a democracy. And second, the way the Electoral College works is a lot of states get ignored. Nobody goes to California, nobody goes to Texas because it's preordained how those states are going to come out. The advantages, if you want to say that there are advantages of the Electoral College, though, are there. I mean, one is a running a campaign to get out the national popular vote would be more expensive. I mean, there were millions and millions of dollars are spent this race, but you would even require more to run a nationwide campaign. So it would increase the cost of campaigning. It would probably ignore small states. People wouldn't actually visit the small states as much as they do right now, at least the small states that are the so-called battleground states. And the biggest advantage might be consider a recount. What would happen in a recount in a national election? I mean, if we remember the vision of what happened in Florida when people on both sides yelling and screaming against each other and as every ballot was counted, if there was a really close election and we had to do a recount, that would mean that every precinct in every state of the country would have to be counted. And imagine the divisiveness and the length of time that period would take. So it may be that the Electoral College helps us against that kind of a crisis.
It would have to be said in that case. I mean, that's the outcome you want. You really want to know who more people wanted for president. And so if that's what it takes, you figure out a way to do that, right?
Yeah. I mean, if we want to move to a popular system, That's exactly right.
So politically, it seems to me, I mean, in this case, Democrats have been disadvantaged these twice in 16 years. So perhaps you say, well, this is something Republicans would never agree to. But has there ever been popular enough sentiment or has there ever been a movement to really, in the modern era, to change this that any kind of political traction?
It's been discussed quite a bit. There has been a question of whether it needs to be done by constitutional amendment or whether it can be done by a different mechanism when somehow an agreement is made by the states that they will tell their electors to vote for whoever got the most popular vote rather than just voting for who got the most popular vote in their particular states. So whether it could be done outside of the constitutional amendment process has also been discussed. But yes, for all the reasons that you suggested at the beginning, this question has been looked at many times with a lot of proposals for reform, precisely because some folks think that would be much more reflective of a true democracy to award the presidency to who got the most votes.
And one of the other reform possibilities is something we haven't talked about, which is the way they're apportioned on a state-by-state basis. Most are winner-take-all, but not all, because, again, not all states have that rule. So explain to us how the votes get to the candidate. Yeah.
In two states, Maine and Nebraska, you don't get the entire electoral votes of that state just by winning the popular vote. You get two for winning the popular vote, and then you get one for each additional congressional district that you get. So Maine has four electoral votes. Senator Clinton won the state of Maine. She got two for winning it. She won the first district, so she got a third for that. But Donald Trump won the other district in Maine. So the end result of the distribution of votes from Maine was that Secretary Clinton got three and Donald Trump got one.
All right. Well, Bill, I want to thank you very much for helping clarify all of that and giving us a little bit of the history. Bill Marshall, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Bill Marshall teaches law at the UNC School of Law. Just ahead, we talk with the first woman to officially compete in the Boston Marathon, and she's doing it again 50 years later. Stay with us on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill.